Laura's popped out of the shop, but I'm glad I've got a chance to talk to you on your own. She laid her hand on mine. Hers was warm. She would kill me if she knew I was talking about her to you, but, well, I know how much you still care about her.
Is it to do with the thing at the tube station?
Not really. I mean, she insists now that she tripped, that she can't have been pushed, and I believe her. In fact, the more I think about it, the more I think that when she initially told me she'd been pushed, she was doing it to get a reaction, like she wanted sympathy. She met my eye. But I think Laura's starting to imagine things. Really weird things.
Like what?
Well, I often have to get up in the night because this baby's pressing on my bladder. About 3 times every night, actually. I'm sure it's nature's way of prepping me for all the sleepless nights ahead. Anyway, the other night I got up and heard a noise down here.
In the kitchen?
Yeah. I came down and Laura was standing by the window. She was just wearing a pair of knickers, nothing else. Rob would have been delighted. And she was staring into the garden. I said her name, and she didn't respond, and I thought, shit, she's sleepwalking.
The fridge emitted a clunking noise that made me jump.
I said her name again, and she turned round. Her whole body was covered in goosebumps. I mean, like she was freezing, even though the heating was on in the house. I didn't know what to do. You're not supposed to wake sleepwalkers, are you?
I don't think so.
Anyway, that's when she spoke. She said, out there, in the trees. And she pointed towards the garden, down where the shed is.
Jesus. I looked past Erin into the garden, which appeared neglected, as if Erin and Rob had decided not to touch it till spring. There was a little copse of apple trees at the end of the lawn, their branches bare, surrounded by damp, mulchy leaves. I could imagine how they looked at night, creepy silhouettes reaching towards the house. I shivered.
Then she walked past me, went up the stairs and back into her room. I woke Rob up to tell him, and he was mainly pissed off that he'd missed the nude show.
Did you go out and take a look?
Yeah, Rob did, but there was nothing there. We didn't expect there to be. She frowned. I'm really worried about her. Add to that the whole thing with her almost falling under a train, and now she's saying she's going to move to the other side of the world. I can't work out if that's the best thing for her or the worst. Can you talk to her? Try to persuade her to see someone. She won't listen to me.
She won't listen to me either, Erin. She stood up, running a hand over her belly. The baby inside had no idea how lucky he was to have this capable, caring woman as his mother.
Well, try again.
Erin went to the loo, and when she came back I told her about my break-in. She was shocked, and asked why I hadn't told her straight away. And she let me use her laptop to go onto all the sites I use, so I could change the passwords. 2 hours later, when I was about to give up waiting for Laura and go back to my flat to begin the painful task of clearing up, the front door slammed and she came into the kitchen. It was 6 o'clock.
"Oh," she said when she saw me.
"Hiya."
"What are you doing here?"
She was carrying a couple of shopping bags, one of which I was pleased to see contained 2 bottles of red wine. She seemed a little spaced out, distracted. I noticed that she was wearing her poppy hair scrunchie, which I thought of as her signature item. The number of times she'd lost it, and we'd spent 30 minutes crawling around the flat, searching for it. "I've had a break-in at home. I came here to use the computer."
"A break-in?"
I explained what had happened, and she looked suitably horrified.
"It's as if we're cursed," she said.
"Laura, don't be silly. You don't believe that, do you?"
"I guess not."
She unpacked the wine from the bag and immediately unscrewed one of the bottles, pouring herself a large glass. "Aren't you going to offer me one?"
"Why? Are you staying?"
"I want to talk to you, Laura."
"Not about Australia, please."
"No. I just want to chat. We're still friends, aren't we? And I don't want to go back to the flat yet. I don't have the energy." She poured me a glass of wine and sat down at the big solid table, and asked me more about the burglary, and for the next hour or so we talked. As the wine slipped down, she relaxed, her moodiness vanishing, and I made sure to stick to innocuous subjects. No reminiscing, no mention of our trip, nothing about our relationship or her plan to move abroad. We talked about mutual friends and TV shows that we used to watch together, the music that we both liked. Erin and Rob came in, and told us they were going to order an Indian takeaway if we wanted some. And the food came, and we ate, opening and drinking our way through the second bottle of wine. It was lovely. For 2 hours, I forgot about all the shit, all the stuff that I had to deal with. I felt like my old self. It was like we were a couple again, the couple we were before. The only negative was this niggle at the back of my head that I needed to ask her about the sleepwalking incident. But I didn't want to spoil the mood. For the first time in 3 months, I felt happy.
"The wine's all gone,"
Laura said with surprise. "How did that happen?" She laughed tipsily.
"I think we drank it."
"Shall I pop out to get more?" She looked up at me through her fringe, a look in her eye that made me tingle. For a while, her leg had been pressed against mine beneath the table. I knew she must be aware of the contact, was thrilled that she hadn't pulled away.
"Actually, I've got a bottle of Jack Daniels in my room."
"Do you want me to go and fetch it?"
"No. Let's stop hogging Erin and Rob's kitchen. We can drink it up there."
I tried my best not to look excited when she said this.
"Come on," she said.
She led me up to the room where she was staying. I had slept here before, when Laura and I had stayed over together, and it was weird to think that Laura was living here now, her clothes filling the wardrobe, her essential possessions piled up against the walls. The room wasn't much bigger than the double bed that filled it, and there was nowhere else to sit, so I perched awkwardly on the end of the bed, while Laura sat cross-legged in the centre, and opened the bottle of J.D. She only had one tumbler, so she poured in some whiskey, took a couple of sips, then passed it to me, jumping up to put some music on. She staggered and half fell onto the bed, giggling and saying, "Whoops!" She was wearing jeans and a jumper, but I could see the shape of her body through the fabric, and longed to touch her. "It's a bit like being a student again, isn't it?" I said, passing the tumbler back to her.
"Yeah, except I was a very boring student. I spent all my time in the library. Little Miss Boring."
"You were never boring."
"Oh, I was at uni, and I had a very boring boyfriend."
"The chairman of the debating society?"
"Julian. He was never happier than when he was mass debating."
She smiled, then giggled, then laughed, and I joined in, and soon there were tears pouring down Laura's cheeks, and I was clutching my stomach. I couldn't breathe, couldn't stop laughing. The joke wasn't even funny, but it was a release of tension, or possibly a sign of how close we both were to hysteria. Finally we got control of ourselves, and Laura wiped her face with the sleeve of her jumper.
"Oh, God," she said, "my stomach hurts."
I held up the bottle, said in a ridiculous attempt at an American accent, "Rock and fucking roll, baby."
"Please don't set me off again."
I remembered what Erin had asked me to. "Laura, you know I'm seeing a therapist. I think it's helping. Erin told me..." She held up a hand.
"I don't want to talk about it. Please."
She giggled.
"I've managed to drink myself into a state of not giving a fuck, okay?"
We were sitting very close together on the bed now. Laura still cross-legged, me with my legs stretched out before me. My head was woozy, my ribs sore. I was intoxicated and happy. I wanted to say something profound, something that would make Laura fall in love with me all over again, that would fix all our problems, make her change her mind about running away. But I couldn't think of anything sensible, let alone profound. As I groped through the fog in my head, a song came on that we both loved, a piano intro, a softly plucked guitar, a deep male voice, and Laura turned her eyes towards me and whispered,
"This song always reminds me of you, you know."
And then we were kissing. Shortly afterwards, when we were both naked and I was inside her, I made a groaning noise, and Laura shushed me, whispering,
"Erin and Rob."
And I was surprised to remember that they existed, that anyone else existed. Her skin against mine, her tongue on my lips, her fingers on my back, the heaviness of her breathing, these were the only things in the world. I'm sure I cried out when I came, and she did too, and then I was slipping into unconsciousness, her limbs wrapped around me, her sweat drying on my skin. Her sleep claimed me. I felt happy, cured, alive, until I woke up. Chapter 15. It was still dark outside, and the bed was cold and smelled stale, the scent of sex and whiskey heavy in the air. I found my jeans on the floor beside the bed and checked my phone, 7:30 a.m. I waited for a minute in case Laura had got up to go to the loo, and when she didn't appear, I got out of bed, retrieved my clothes, which were crumpled in a pile on the floor, and went downstairs. There were a couple of coffee mugs on the side in the kitchen, but no sign of Laura. I assumed Rob must have gone to work, and that Erin was still in bed. Where was Laura? I left the house. I felt wretched. My head throbbed, and the rest of my body ached. I felt about 90 years old. Before leaving the house, I had found a little box of painkillers in the bathroom cabinet and swallowed a couple. Camden was waking up. Early birds heading to work, people queuing at bus stops. A couple of runners jogged by as I walked down towards the market. I had an idea of where Laura might have gone. I knew her favourite spot in this part of the city. As I walked, I thought about the previous night. Though it had only been a few hours ago, I could only remember glimpses of skin against skin, a sense memory. I so wanted it to mean something, and for Laura to feel the same way, but what were the chances of that? She had been drunk, emotional, we both had been. Sex with your ex, it was textbook. If my male friends could see inside my head, I thought, they would want to slap some sense into me, tell me to give up and move on. What they wouldn't understand, though, was that I felt like I was drowning, and Laura was dry land. I didn't know how to get through this, through everything, without her. Why had we reacted to the aftermath of Romania in such different ways? One of us wanted to cling, the other needing to get away, a mutually impossible situation. Deep down, I knew the answer, and I didn't know what to do about it. I was right about Laura's whereabouts. Camden Lock was one of her favourite spots, but only when it was quiet, when the crowds, who flocked to the market, the bars and noodle stalls, the goth boutiques and remaining record shops, had gone home, or not descended on the borough yet. Down by the still water of the canal it was quiet, especially at this hour, in this weather, a few degrees colder, and the water would freeze over. Laura was sitting on a low wall beside the narrow towpath, wrapped in her green parka. She stared at the water, not moving. I watched her from the market courtyard above, hesitant and unsure if I would be welcome. Perhaps, now I knew she was safe, I should sneak away, go back home and call her later. Or would I be better going down and talking to her now, telling her how I felt? I wrestled with the question. But before I could make a decision, I saw something that overrode my dilemma. Someone was watching her. I could see him standing beneath the bridge, half concealed by shadows. For a fleeting moment he came out into the dim morning light, but he was wearing a hood, so I couldn't see his face. He was slim with an athletic build. He stared at Laura, who was oblivious to his presence. "Hey!" I shouted. Laura looked towards me, while the man retreated beneath the bridge into the darkness. I ran down the steps, ignoring Laura's cry of, "Daniel!" and accelerated along the towpath and under the bridge. When I emerged on the other side, he was ascending the steps onto the main road. As if he'd hailed it, a bus glided to a stop and he jumped aboard. I ran as fast as I could, but as I reached the bus stop, panting and sweating, the bus set off. There was no sign of the man through the window. Cursing, I jogged back down the steps and walked along the path to Laura.
"What the hell are you doing?"
she said, her words harsh, breath pluming the frigid air. "That guy was spying on you."
"What are you talking about? You were spying on me."
I stepped towards her, tried to put my hand on her arm, but she jerked away. "Laura, I woke up and you were gone. I was worried about you."
"Why?"
"I still care about you, Laura." Her long strawberry blonde hair stirred in the breeze. Her nose was pink from the cold, and two more spots of colour burned in her cheeks. She exhaled another cloud of ice.
"Daniel, you need to stop this. Last night we were drunk."
She looked directly at me.
"It didn't mean anything."
"You don't mean that." She wouldn't meet my eye.
"I do."
Before I could respond, she turned away and marched up the steps. I ran after her.
"Laura, for God's sake, this isn't you." "Please, Daniel, don't beg. It's not you.
I wasn't going to beg. For fuck's sake, why are you being so cold? That isn't you.
Maybe this is what I'm like now. This is the new me.
I shook my head. I refused to believe that. I could sense the market traders who were setting up their stalls, watching us. I reached out to her and she shrank away.
You need to forget me. We shouldn't have slept together last night. It was a mistake. I know you must have seen it as a sign that we were going to get back together, but we can't be together any more, Daniel, ever. Nothing will change that. I'm moving away, and you'll never see me again.
She put her hand on my forearm.
You need to forget about me and move on.
I opened my mouth to argue, but thought better of it. She was right. I was coming close to begging, or at least verging on harassment. Her words hurt me, but made me frustrated and angry too. The best thing I could do now was retreat, go home, and give her the space she wanted. But before I went, there was one more thing I needed to say. Laura, that man was watching you. She looked down at the bridge and shook her head.
No, he was just some random guy. You probably frightened the life out of him.
I hesitated. Was she right? No. He was watching you. Specifically you. Doubt crossed her face, but then she shook her head again.
No, he wasn't.
She strode away again, and I hurried to keep up. Where are you going? I asked.
Back to Erin's.
She broke contact with me and walked away quickly, out of the courtyard and onto the high street, which was teeming with people now. I stood there, frozen to the spot, for what felt like a long time. It wasn't just the crushing realization that she really meant it, that our relationship was actually over. It was more than that. Worse than that. I was certain the man under the bridge had been there specifically to watch Laura, and now I had to go back to my ransacked flat. As I trudged back to the main road, I felt a prickle on the back of my neck, like I, too, was being watched. Chapter 16. I spent the whole day clearing up the flat, taking the opportunity to reorganize my possessions, reshelving books by color-coding the spines, arranging DVDs by genre, folding and neatly arranging my clothes. I filled 3 bin bags with rubbish, got rid of everything in my drawers and cupboards that I didn't use or need anymore, put my loose photographs into albums. I changed the bedsheets, vacuumed and cleaned every surface. When I was done, the flat looked better than it had at any time since Laura had left, and I felt exhausted, but calm. I found a chilled beer at the back of the fridge, sweaty with condensation, and sank into the sofa with it, trying not to think about anything at all. The intercom buzzed. Laura? I jumped up, lifted the handset. Yes?
Hey, it's me.
Oh, Jake. I buzzed him up. As he walked in, throwing his coat onto the back of a chair, he said,
Thrilled to see you too, Dan.
Sorry, I thought...
Holy shit!
He was spinning in a circle, his mouth agape.
Have you had a team of cleaners in?
Actually, a team of burglars.
You what?
I explained while I made him a coffee. Jake didn't drink alcohol, mostly because his mum was an alcoholic who had ripped their family apart with her drinking. He drank a hell of a lot of coffee, though, 10 or 12 cups a day, though he claimed he was naturally full of vim and energy, that his unflagging hyperactivity was not caffeine-induced. Jake was disgustingly good-looking, so much so that going out with him could be a depressing experience, girls' eyes sliding over me and fixing on him, this wiry, mixed-race guy with the boundless energy and charisma. His mum was a former model from Manchester, his dad a musician from Trinidad, and Jake had inherited her looks and his dad's talent.
Fuck,
Jake said, eyes wide, after I'd finished telling him about the burglary. I decided not to tell him about all the other stuff that had been going on, including sleeping with Laura. I knew he'd think I was an idiot. Jake had introduced Laura and me, spent the next few years telling us that we owed him, and that we had better name our first son after him. When Laura left, he had been shocked and disappointed, but although he wanted us to get back together, he had also taken on the role of cheerleader, telling me I needed to stop moping and start living again. "So what's happening with you?" I asked, finishing my beer.
"What do you mean? I told you about my gig tonight. We discussed it the other day. Don't tell me you've forgotten.
The truth was that I couldn't remember. I had the vaguest memory of having a conversation with Jake earlier in the week, but had no recollection of what it was about.
Anyway, you're coming. You can't sit around licking your wounds for the rest of your life. I'm worried about you, man.
Where's the gig?
I can't believe you've forgotten,
he told me again. It was a large pub near Euston.
Going to be some A&R people there. This guy contacted me after checking out my YouTube channel and wants to see me live.
I pictured myself in the crowd at the gig, all the people and noise.
Don't say no, Dan. I don't want to sound like a ponce, but I could really do with your support. Come on. You really can't sit around here festering forever. Come out. Have fun. There will be girls there and everything. Tell them you know me and...
He winked and made a click-click sound with his tongue. I sighed. Okay, I'll come. But I'm really not interested in meeting another woman. He grinned and raised his mug.
Cheers! By the way, you really need to get some decent coffee. This stuff tastes like Nescafe.
It is Nescafe.
You know they murder babies, don't you?
I zoned out for a moment.
Nestle, he prodded. They...
Yes, yes, I know. The baby milk thing. I got up and went over to the cupboard, retrieved the jar of coffee and dropped it in the bin.
Happy now? He stared at me. You really do need to get out more, Dan. You look awful. And you're acting kind of crazy. Getting forgetful.
Maybe I am, I said.
Maybe you are what?
Crazy. The pub was rammed, even though it was a frosty Thursday night in November. I sat with Jake in a tiny room behind the bar, where he was getting ready, tuning his guitar and hyping himself up, getting into the zone. For years he had sung in a series of bands that had got nowhere, never quite being what record companies were looking for, frustratedly watching lesser rival bands get signed and sometimes have hits. There was a guy called Zach Love, not his real name, who had at one point been in a band with Jake. Zach had left the band to go on the X Factor, reaching the live finals and having a few big hits. Word was that he was on the verge of breaking America. Zack's success sent Jake into a tailspin of self-doubt and misery, but he had picked himself up and, propelled by rivalry with his former friend, started writing much better songs, working on his image, and generally transforming himself. His YouTube channel had gained huge numbers of new subscriptions recently after one of his homemade videos went viral. As I left the backstage area, after giving him a good luck hug, I could feel it. He was on the verge of a breakthrough. As I pushed my way through the crowd, I overheard a pair of girls talking about Jake.
"Do you see the new video we posted yesterday?" "God, yeah, those biceps," she groaned. "Do you think he's got a girlfriend?" "Nah, Tara said he's single, but don't get your hopes up. He's mine. He's probably gay anyway."
I smiled as I passed them, tempted to give them some inside info. At the bar, I bought two bottles of beer so I wouldn't have to queue again for a while, and found a spot close to the stage, behind another group of excited young women. There were a lot of guys here, too, but many of them appeared to have been dragged along by their girlfriends. I wondered if Jake would still talk to me if he became properly famous, or if he'd trade me in for a new bunch of rock star actor model mates. Then I'd be properly alone, with my girlfriend living in Australia and my best mate not wanting to know me. I sank my first beer, drowning the encroaching self-pity. A hush came over the crowd as the MC announced Jake, and then the girls in the crowd and some of the guys were whooping and grabbing each other as he came on with his guitar and, with a little smile, started to play. He was great. I'd heard tons of his songs over the years, as he encouraged me to listen to his demos and go to his gigs, but there was no doubt this latest crop was a league above his earlier efforts. Envy had worked. Barring a severe dose of bad luck, he was going to be a star. As he played, I noticed a young woman with blonde hair standing near me. She was wearing tight black jeans and a purple top, very little makeup. She was stunning. The second time I glanced at her, she smiled at me, and before I knew it, she was standing beside me.
"I love this guy," she said, her lips close to my ear,
though the music wasn't so loud that we couldn't have a conversation. She had an Eastern European accent. I was immediately reminded of Alina and shuddered.
"Are you okay?" the blonde woman said. "You look like you saw a ghost."
I wanted to get away, but the crowd around us was too dense. I was temporarily trapped. I made a conscious decision to relax. This woman was gorgeous. And maybe I needed to heed Jake's advice, stop being such a recluse. I was just about to tell her that Jake was my best mate, but changed my mind. I could see how the conversation would go. She would be surprised, and I would try to impress her, but all she would want to know is if I could introduce her to Jake. Was this the way my life would go now? I would be known as Jake's friend, a way to meet the big rock star. "He's great," I said. "I love this song." She stuck out her hand.
"I'm Camelia."
"Daniel, where are you from?" She grinned and said,
"Belsize Park. I like your name, Daniel. Makes me think of someone escaping the lion's den."
"Yeah, that's my job. I'm a lion tamer. I ran away to join the circus when I was 10, and I've got 2 pet lions in my shed." She smiled generously and laid her hand on my arm. I swallowed. "So where are you from, really?"
"Romania. But don't worry, I'm not a vampire."
"Oh." She tilted her head.
"You want me to be a vampire?"
"No. Sorry, I was just... It doesn't matter." I paused. Her being from Romania had flustered me. It was stupid. London was full of people of every nationality, and Romania was part of the European Union, so its citizens could come work here whenever they liked. I could hardly go into a meltdown every time I met someone from the country where my life had changed. "Your English is excellent." "Oh, sorry, did that sound condescending?"
"No, it was a compliment, so thank you. I've lived here for ages. Ah, I love this one."
She turned towards the stage, nodded her head and swayed her hips to the music. Her eyes were half closed, a little smile on her pretty face. I noticed other men in the crowd watching her greedily, and I felt strangely protective towards her, and flattered that she had chosen to talk to me. I lifted my beer to my lips and found that the bottle was empty. "Do you want a drink, Camelia?"
"Sure, I'll have what you're having."
I struggled through the crowd to the bar, Jake's voice loud in my ears, a small pocket of the audience singing along. My blood was thrumming. After a long wait, I bought our drinks and headed back to where Camelia had been standing. She wasn't there. I looked around, craning my neck, but there was no sign of her. Great. I told myself it was stupid to feel so disappointed, but I couldn't help it. There was something about her, not just her looks, but her playful tone, the energy she gave off. Oh, God. Laura. I was hit by a wave of guilt, but then remembered how Laura had been that morning, the tone of her voice as she told me it was over.
"Hey!"
I turned, flooded with relief, at the same time chiding myself for feeling so relieved.
"Sorry, I had to use the bathroom, and the line was unbelievable. I think there was a couple having sex in one of the stalls."
She rolled her eyes.
"So tacky. Although I guess I understand people getting carried away."
I definitely wasn't imagining the way she looked at me then. I was momentarily speechless.
"It's so hot, isn't it?" she said, shrugging off her jacket.
Something fell out of her jacket pocket, and she stooped to pick it up. It was her phone. She slipped it back into the pocket. From the stage, Jack said,
"Thank you, see you soon."
"I'd better get backstage," I said.
"You know him?"
"Damn. Yes, we're old friends."
"Wow, that's interesting."
I wasn't sure what she meant, but before I could ask, she said,
"So are you going to introduce me?"
I sighed inwardly. When Jake introduced me to Laura, I assumed she was one of his former conquests, but she found this idea hilarious. She said he simply wasn't her type.
"Yeah, he's good-looking, charismatic and cool, but I'm not interested in those things."
"Thanks," I'd laughed. Why was I thinking about competing with Jake? I wasn't looking for a new girlfriend. I didn't even want a one-night stand. My ego felt sore, though. Camelia had lifted my spirits, and now she was about to shift her attention to my best friend. "Come on, then," I said, and she followed me back behind the bar and through to the back room where Jake sat, sweating and smiling, the guitar propped against the wall. His manager, Robin, was in the room, talking about how he'd been standing with the A&R guy, who'd been creaming his pants. "That was fantastic," I enthused. After lavishing him with praise, I gestured towards my companion, whom Jake had been watching since we'd entered the room, and said, "This is Camelia."
"You are pretty good," she said in a cool, disinterested voice.
Then she turned to me.
"Thanks for introducing us, Daniel.
Can we go now, though, do you think? Once again I was speechless as she took my hand and pulled me through the door. I glanced back at the open-mouthed Jake and shrugged an apology. He waved it off, a big smile on his face. Camelia led me through the back door and out into the street. It was freezing outside, but I didn't care. Camelia was still carrying her jacket. The cold clearly didn't bother her. I was about to say something about this when she pulled me into a shop doorway and kissed me. Her lips were soft. It felt good, but strange, the unfamiliar shape of her lips and the taste of her mouth, a faint trace of cigarettes. I hadn't kissed anyone apart from Laura in years. I was so busy marvelling at the fact that Camelia was kissing me and trying to push Laura's image out of my head that I was unable to relax and enjoy it. I broke away. She stared at me, confused, then moved her lips back towards mine. I turned my face away. I'm sorry.
What's the matter?
She looked hurt, pissed off. I can't. I've got a girlfriend. She made a little snorting noise. I have to go, I said. Passers-by were looking at us, this couple having what looked like a break-up conversation in a doorway.
What? Come on.
She moved towards me, but I stepped away. She looked stunned, as if no man had ever rejected her before. Perhaps they hadn't. I could sense her searching her head for something to say. It made me think of a robot shuffling through possible responses before finding one, and this image made the chance that I'd give in to her advances vanish completely.
"Daniel, I like you a lot," she said. "I thought we had a connection."
This was awkward. "Camelia, you're gorgeous, but
you have a girlfriend."
She took another step towards me.
"I won't tell her."
She leaned in for another kiss, but I turned my face away like a shy virgin. Again she looked shocked.
"Do you have something against Romanian women?" she asked, tilting her head. "When I told you where I come from, you seemed upset."
There wasn't enough air in my lungs for me to reply.
"Oh, my God," she said, stepping back. "You really do have a problem with Romanians. You're not one of those people who hate immigrants, are you?"
"God, no," I said. She didn't appear convinced.
"Well, you certainly have a problem with something," she said. "Just me, maybe."
I tried to laugh it off. "How could I have a problem with someone who looks like you?" She softened just a bit.
"So it's just Romania in general, then?"
A little playful now.
"You should visit, maybe. Give us a chance. It's a beautiful country."
"Oh, I know. I've been."
"Oh, yes? How long ago?"
Again, I had trouble speaking.
"What is it? You had a bad experience?"
"No, I couldn't form a sentence."
"Do you want to tell me about it?"
she said, looking into my eyes. "No, I don't," I hastily added. "There's nothing to tell."
"Are you sure?"
She laid a hand on my arm, and for a moment I was tempted to take her home, to bed, to lose myself in her, to tell her everything. But that moment passed quickly, and I shook my head. "I'm sure."
"Fine."
Before I could say anything else, she spun round and dashed into the traffic, her jacket flapping in her grip. I yelled out as a car swerved around her, a bus swayed, the driver leaning on his horn. Traffic in both lanes screeched to a halt. Someone on the pavement screamed. I dashed to the curb, expecting to see her dead, flattened in the road. But she was gone. In my peripheral vision, I had seen something drop from her jacket as she'd moved away from me. It was her phone, fallen from her pocket again. I held it in my palm for a moment, then slipped it into my pocket. Chapter 17. I needed to go home, but didn't feel up to using public transport. I checked my wallet and found that I had no cash left, so walked down the busy street to a cash point. A homeless man lay by the wall at the front of the bank, shivering inside a ragged sleeping bag, his eyes shut tight against the bitter cold. I slotted my card into the machine and keyed in my PIN, choosing to withdraw £50. The machine beeped and told me the transaction was denied. Maybe the machine was running low on cash. I tried £30. Again, it was rejected. Irritated, I pressed another couple of buttons to check my balance, waiting while the ATM contacted my bank before returning with the answer. But the number on the screen made no sense. No sense at all. £2,998 OD. Overdrawn. £2 away from my overdraft limit. This was my current account. Most of my remaining money from the deal with Skittle, a sum that was diminishing fast, was in my business account. But there should have been some money, a few £100 at least, in my current account. I wasn't great at keeping up to date with my balance, but it wasn't possible that I was almost £3,000 overdrawn. The cashpoint machine spat my card out, and I wandered, stunned, to the nearest bus stop. I tried to work out how much money I'd spent in the last week, if there had been any large transactions that I'd forgotten about. A bus pulled up. Luckily, I had a few quid on my Oyster, so I jumped on and headed up the stairs, almost losing my footing as the bus jerked and swayed. There was a seat free at the back, and I sat there behind the drunks, a thrumming in my ears, trying to process what had just happened. My stolen laptop. Whoever had burgled my flat and taken my laptop must have got into my bank account. I had alerted the bank as soon as I'd returned to the flat to find it burgled, but clearly I hadn't been quick enough. Then a new, horrible thought struck me. What if they'd emptied my business account too? Was that possible? I took my phone out of my pocket. As usual, the battery was almost dead. With fumbling hands, I attempted to log into my bank account on my phone, pressing the wrong digit, getting the password wrong twice, but eventually logging in. Thank God, my business account appeared untouched. I tried to check the list of recent transactions, but the screen filled with the swirling circle of death before going blank. My mind followed suit. As the bus bumped and rattled, I pressed my forehead against the greasy window and watched the streets of London go past, trying not to think, trying not to feel. A fox had been in the bins outside my flat. One of my neighbours had left what had clearly been a stuffed black bin liner on the pavement, and it was torn open, segments of pizza and old nappies strewn across the path. This would no doubt lead to a poster in the lobby. I stepped over it and unlocked the door, dragging myself up the stairs to my flat. As soon as I went inside, I knew something else was wrong. I had tidied it and sorted out the chaos before going out with Jake, writing everything the burglar had messed up, and it was still clean and tidy. The cups and glasses I'd used earlier sat beside the sink. So what was different? I was so shocked by what I saw that I actually rubbed my eyes with my fists, like a cartoon character. My laptop was sitting on the desk, plugged into its charger. Beside it lay the iPad that had been stolen. The Bluetooth speaker, iPad, and PlayStation 4 were back in their usual spots, too. I picked up the laptop, turning it over in my hands. There was the tiny dent that I'd caused when I'd dropped it a few months before. There was the scratch on the back. I was sure that if I checked the serial number, it would match. This was my computer, the computer that had been stolen 2 days ago. What the hell was it doing back here? I opened it and logged on. It seemed to be untouched. The same programs were open that I'd been using the other day. I had a habit of leaving my computer switched on all the time, having heard that Macs prefer to stay awake with whatever programs or documents I'm using remaining open. My memory was a little hazy, but these appeared to be the same programs I'd been using 2 days ago, when I left to go to see Claudia Sauvage, my therapist. To be safe, I opened my virus-checking software and started a scan of the machine. All of a sudden, I felt sick. My skin went cold, all the way to my scalp, and a wave of nausea crashed over me. I made it to the bathroom just in time, leaning over the toilet, retching and feeling everything I'd eaten and drunk that day violently exit my body. I sat on the bathroom floor. I couldn't think straight. I really couldn't deal with this tonight. After checking the results of the virus scan, all clear, I went into my bedroom. As I undressed, I found Camellia's phone in my pocket. She would probably call it when she realized it was missing. But tonight I needed to sleep undisturbed, so I switched it off and put it into the bedside drawer. Sometime during the night, I dreamed that Camellia was kissing me. except she had sharp teeth and kept biting my lips.
"Sorry," she murmured as blood dripped from my mouth, "but tell me about the terrible things you've seen."
She was naked, but her body didn't look as it should. Her shoulder blades protruded, her ribs stuck out like the grill on a vintage car, and deep pink scars encircled her wrists and ankles. Blood continued to drip from my lips, as the dream camellia dropped to her hands and knees and crawled across the floor towards me, and I backed away until I was against the wall. Something small and square stuck to my back, and when I tried to pull it off, I felt it pulling my skin off like it was super glued to me. I woke up, gasping for air. The next morning, after showering and drinking 3 pints of water, and taking what was becoming a daily dose of painkillers, I called the bank. I was transferred to a member of the fraud team, a young woman with a northeastern accent.
"We've been trying to contact you," she said. "Did you get our messages?"
"No. Did you leave a voicemail? Sometimes it takes a day or two for them to come through." She didn't sound like she believed me. Had I heard the messages and forgotten about them, just as I'd forgotten my conversation with Jake?
"There were a couple of large transactions on your debit card yesterday. £500 was withdrawn from a cash point machine in East London. There was also a transaction of £1,600 at the Apple Store in Regent Street."
£1,600. I glanced at my laptop. That was how much I'd paid for my MacBook Pro.
"Why didn't you stop them?" I asked.
"I thought the bank automatically blocked unusual transactions like that. How on earth were 2 made without being stopped?" She sounded annoyed.
"Both of these transactions were made at exactly the same time. They were picked up immediately afterwards, and your account was frozen. That was when we tried to contact you."
"But I didn't get the message. What number did you call?"
She read out a mobile number.
"That's not my number."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes, of course I'm sure.
Please hold."
I paced up and down the room while I waited for her to come back on the line. I looked out of the window. The fox that had ripped open the bins was standing on the front path, eating. I banged on the glass, and it trotted away up the road, a slice of pizza clenched between its jaws. The woman from the fraud team said,
"You changed your contact details 2 days ago, on the 23rd.
"I didn't. I... Oh. The person who had stolen my computer must have logged into my account and changed my phone number. I explained this to the woman, who took the correct number. Then I thought of something. "I was robbed when I was in Romania last summer. Could someone have used my old card?"
"Not if it was cancelled, which according to my records it was. These transactions went through on your current card. I expect it was cloned. It's a common occurrence, unfortunately. When you were burgled, was your debit card in the house?"
I tried to remember. "Yes, I think so."
"Then it was probably cloned by your burglar. They use these machines. They swipe the card and download the information from the magnetic strip to create new ones. I have already cancelled your card, and you'll be sent a new one. You will get the money back, Mr. Sullivan, but it may take up to a week. In the meantime, if you need cash, you should go to your local branch."
After I'd ended the call, I went over to my desk and picked up the laptop. I had half expected to find it missing again when I'd woken up, to discover that its reappearance had been part of a dream. But it was still here. I had been, how could I put it, unburgled. I called the police. Chapter 18.
"So, let me get this straight, Mr. Sullivan. Somebody broke in, stole your laptop and some other gadgets, then brought it all back."
The police constable's name was, confusingly, Sergeant, PC Sergeant. I hoped he never got promoted. He was 6'2" and had that weird Fred Flintstone-like grey stubble on his face. He looked around my flat, taking in the neatness, everything in its place, looking more like a team of cleaners had broken in than burglars.
"Maybe they had an attack of conscience," Sergeant said. "I read about this guy who stole £100 from a pub, then 20 years later sent it back with a note of apology. But your repentant burglar got an attack of the guilts much quicker."
"I feel like you're not taking this seriously," I said. "I reported this when it happened 2 days ago. An officer gave me a crime number for my insurance company." Sergeant prodded a key on my laptop, making the screen flicker into life.
"Does your computer appear to have been tampered with in any way?
No. I scanned it for viruses, and there's nothing there. I checked the browser history, too, and there's no recorded activity since I last used it. I had already told him about the fraudulent use of my bank card, and how the woman at the bank had said it had probably been cloned by the burglar. "What are you going to do?" I asked. Sergeant set down the cup of tea I'd made him when he arrived. "There's very little we can do. Your bank is dealing with the card fraud, and as for the burglary, you should think yourself lucky."
"Lucky? Don't forget to contact your insurance company and cancel your claim."
He moved towards the door.
"I don't think you understand. Someone is trying to mess with my head." "A practical joke, you mean?"
A pain was blooming in my skull, a sharp, white, stabbing sensation like fat needles penetrating the soft flesh of my brain.
No. More sinister than that.
Sinister?
I opened my mouth. But what was I supposed to say? As well as this apparently phantom burglary, someone might have attempted to push Laura under a tube train, and I thought I'd seen someone watching her. It all sounded very weak, and Sergeant was already looking at me like I was unhinged. The only concrete part was the fraudulent use of my card, but as Sergeant had pointed out, the bank were dealing with that, and the police would deal directly with them. I could imagine what Sergeant would say if I told him my card had been used to buy a new laptop of all things, the same model, going by the price as the one I owned.
"Listen, Mr. Sullivan, it seems to me like you're under a lot of strain," Sergeant said. "Maybe you're working too hard. Either that or a friend played a practical joke on you."
He pushed the front door open and went out into the hallway.
"Take care."
"But..." He descended the stairs. Seconds after hearing the outer door shutting, I heard another door shut. The woman downstairs, stepping back into her flat after coming out to see what was going on. I filled a glass with cold water and sat down. I needed to get everything straight in my head. There was a simple explanation for almost everything. Laura had imagined being pushed at the tube station, and it was indeed a random person watching her in Camden. My card had been cloned and used here in London. It was a common occurrence. Had happened to Jake once. So one question remained. Why had the thief brought my laptop back? And would they come back again? If they did, I wanted to be prepared. I went onto Google and searched for home security, finding what I was looking for, a simple CCTV system. I ordered it and wondered if it was possible to buy a man-trap, or a device that shot poisoned darts. I smiled to myself. That was crazy thinking. And besides, if I bought a trap, I'd probably walk into it myself. Chapter 19. Daniel, trying to get hold of you. It's urgent. Call me. The police had been gone for a few hours, and I'd been napping on the sofa when my phone pinged. It was a message from Erin. I groped for the phone, which lay on the carpet by the sofa, and the moment I read it, a shot of adrenaline jerked me awake. My clothes were damp with sweat, and there was a patch of drool on the cushion my head had been resting on. I rang her immediately.
"Daniel,"
she said, picking up after a single ring.
"Oh, God!"
Her voice was hoarse. I sucked in a breath, dreading the worst.
"What is it?" "It's Laura. She... Oh, fuck!"
She was crying. My stomach lurched like I'd gone over a bump in the road.
"She's in hospital. UCL. I need you to come, now."
Erin was leaning against the wall in the ward that Laura had been admitted to, a plastic cup of water in her hand. Her bump was huge. I could barely imagine how she could stand up straight. I rushed up to her.
"Where is she? Is she all right?"
Erin sniffed and grabbed hold of my hand. I wondered where Rob was. At work, I assumed.
"She's okay. She's recovering. They pumped her stomach, and the doctor I just spoke to said she's lucky. If I hadn't found her almost as soon as she took the overdose..."
She trailed off.
"I can't believe... What did she take?"
"A mix of sleeping pills and antidepressants. Something called Zopiclone and Trazodone, which is apparently prescribed for anxiety."
She held up her phone.
"I looked it up."
I stared at her.
"Where did she get them?"
"From her doctor, I guess."
I knew Laura had suffered from insomnia ever since we'd returned from Europe. but she hadn't been taking anything for it, not while we were together anyway. Had she started taking pills after she left me? I hadn't seen her take a tablet the other night, after we'd had sex, though that didn't mean much. She'd been so drunk that she wouldn't have needed one. "Oh, Laura," I said, my eyes stinging. "I want to see her." Erin and I had taken seats outside the ward. "You can't at the moment. She's asleep. The doctor said they're going to keep her in for a couple of days for observation. He asked me loads of questions."
"Like what?"
"Like, had she attempted suicide before? Does she drink excessively or take illegal drugs? He wanted to know about her support network, too."
"And what did you tell him?"
"Well, I told him that her family live at the other end of the country, but that she has friends here. I've called her Mum already, but they can't make it till tomorrow."
"Typical."
"But, Daniel, I need to talk to you about what she was like when I found her."
Her voice dropped to a near whisper.
"I heard her shouting, so went up to her room and knocked. When I went in, she was sitting on the bed, staring at the window. I didn't notice the empty pill packets at first. They were on the other side of her."
I waited for her to continue, heart thudding.
"She kept staring at the window, and then she started jabbering, muttering, and pointing towards the garden. It was really hard to work out what she was saying. Something about being followed, about a ghost. That's what she kept saying. And she said something weird about her skin, something about tarantulas, and how her skin wouldn't grow back. Her eyes were blank, kind of cloudy. It was really scary. And then she crumpled, just fell sideways onto the bed. That's when I saw the pill boxes and called an ambulance."
Erin turned her head towards me. Her hands rested on her belly as if she were trying to protect her unborn child from all the horror and pain in the world.
"Daniel, what the hell happened to you and Laura on that trip?"
Chapter 20. Laura lay in that grey space between waking and sleeping, lingering voices from her dreams merging with sounds from the real world. Somebody coughing, something beeping, a wheel squeaking across a hard floor. She thought she could hear babies crying too, which made her bury her head beneath the pillow. As she emerged from sleep, she could hear two women talking, but she couldn't make out their words, and it took her a minute or two to work out who they might be. Nurses, that was the answer, because she was in hospital, and with that memory came the jolting realization of what she'd done. Her insides felt poisoned, her stomach and throat sore from where they'd stuck the tubes inside her. The doctor who'd talked to her when she'd woken up, after the drugs had been pumped from her body, had been soft-spoken. But behind his soft words, she could sense reproach. "There are hundreds of genuinely sick people in this hospital, people who want to live. You are wasting our time." "If it wasn't for your friend," the doctor had said. Erin had saved her. Good old Erin, her best friend, the friend she could count on, the person who'd given her somewhere to stay without asking too many questions, who was gentle and kind and compassionate. The bitch. Why had she interfered? If she'd left Laura alone, it would all be over now. She'd be free. It had come to her yesterday, in a flash, not of light, but of darkness, that her idea about going to Australia was foolish, because the other side of the world wasn't far enough away. Sunshine and distance couldn't heal her, protect her, or make her hate herself any less. Nor, she realized, could time. The skin she had shed was never going to grow back. She had lain on her bed in her tiny room and stared at the wall, and as she listened to her heart pounding in her chest, the darkness creeping through her veins, cold and shivering, and not aware she was crying until she felt the wetness on her face, she knew what she had to do. She must have been sobbing when she took the pills. That was her big mistake, because the noise had brought Erin to her room. And there was still time for her to be saved. Though saved wasn't the right word. No, Erin had condemned Laura to more suffering. She had seen Daniel here earlier. He had come onto the ward, sat beside her bed. As soon as she saw him coming, she had shut her eyes, pretending to be asleep. She knew exactly what he would say, and she didn't want to hear it. Seeing him reminded her why she felt like this. She wished she hadn't encouraged him by getting drunk and sleeping with him the other night.
When he had leaned over her bed this afternoon and whispered that he loved her, and she could hear the thickness of tears in his voice, she had expected to feel the urge to cry herself. But she'd felt nothing. At least that part of her had gone numb. All she wanted to do was sleep, but it was no use. She was as wide awake as if she'd ingested a bag of speed. It wasn't helped by the conversation between two nurses she'd overheard after darkness fell. An old man had been spotted hanging around the maternity unit, hovering around the sick babies who were kept apart from their mothers. When staff challenged him, he strode off. The images this conjured up of somebody stealing babies, harming them, made Laura's insides churn with dread. She opened her eyes and squinted at the clock on the bedside cabinet. It was 2:20 a.m. All the other women in the ward were asleep, one of them tossing and turning, another snoring. Laura tried to sit up and recoiled from the flare of pain in her head, like she'd been struck by a hammer, falling back again. She pulled the sheet up over her face. As she lay there, listening to the faint snoring from the other end of the ward, she became aware of a presence close to her bed. Strange. She hadn't heard anyone enter the ward, nor had she heard any of the other patients get out of their beds. But what other explanation could there be? As a tendril of cold crept beneath the hospital sheets, it felt like someone had opened a window and let the frigid February air enter the room. Goosebumps rippled across her flesh. She was about to get up and find the window so she could close it when she heard the voice. "Laura!" She went rigid beneath the thin sheet. The voice was soft, close to a whisper. "It's me." She knew exactly who it was. It was a voice she would never forget, a voice she had last heard rising in a scream, then abruptly falling silent. It was the voice of a dead woman, and she realized in that moment that the glimpses of black clothes and white skin that she'd seen following her, that she thought she'd imagined, must be real. The presence she'd sensed in the central London streets and among the trees at the end of Erin and Rob's garden, it wasn't her imagination, it was real. It was a ghost. "You mustn't do it," the dead woman whispered. She was standing right by the bed now. Laura kept her eyes shut tight, the thin sheet forming a barrier in case the ghost turned hostile. "You mustn't kill yourself yet." Laura was crying now. Crying from the memory of a decision that had changed everything. "I need you," the ghost said. "I need you to stay alive." And Laura threw the sheet forward, jerking upright, the pain in her skull gone. The ghost was gone too. Chapter 21 I trudged home through the freezing London streets, reeling from seeing Laura in her hospital bed, so pale and fragile, with dark circles around her eyes. She had been asleep during visiting hour, despite the chatter around us in the ward. Erin went home, angry with me for refusing to answer all her questions and needing to rest. After murmuring to Laura and fighting back tears, I sat and waited for a while in case she woke up. Tomorrow, her mum and dad would arrive in a cloud of self-importance. Erin had phoned them, and, knowing them as I did, I was less than shocked to learn that they weren't planning to rush straight to London from their home in Cornwall. They had an important dinner, something to do with work. I had warned Erin not to tell them that Laura had talked about ghosts.
"What happened to you on that trip?"
I didn't, couldn't answer. I tried to make sense of what Erin had recounted. Skin, tarantulas, ghosts. I looked back at Erin. "Do you know about Laura and her ghost?" I asked, keeping my voice low so the other people in the waiting room wouldn't hear. I waggled my fingers as I said ghost, putting the word in inverted commas.
"A ghost?"
I took a deep breath. I had to tell her this much. "Yeah, I know. When I first went down to visit Laura's parents after we'd been together for a few months, Laura's mum made a sneering joke about Laura believing in nonsense. When I asked Laura what her mum meant, Laura completely clammed up. But I eventually got it out of her."
"Go on."
"When she was 12, Laura started to believe that there was a ghost living in her house. the ghost of another preteen girl, one who had apparently died there. This ghost, her name was Beatrice, would come